Ed and Rizan Ferrelli on 2FM
with Virgin Mobile. Go from scrolling through stories to creating your own. Freedom is calling. Virgin Mobile. Bring on amazing.
When I heard about this story of my next guest, I said, get that woman into the studio right now because it is remarkable and I can't wait for you all to hear it. Rachel Gatto, good morning.
Good morning to you, Jennifer.
We were just chatting off air there. You had a lovely night to yourself there because you travelled up from Galway. Galway's home for you. And what brought you to Galway, first of all?
Oh, it's always one of those stories. It's a romantic story.
Oh, go on.
I know. We all love them. I met a lovely man called Malcolm and I ended up moving from Kinsale direction up to Galway about 9 years ago now.
Okay. Mm. Okay. So how did you come to live in Ireland? It says here your family pitched up here in a boat on your way to New Zealand.
It's true.
That's true.
My parents left the north of England on a big, big old Baltic trader, which actually is basically a wooden classic old boat.
Yeah.
And she was big enough to house the family. And they sold the house in the north of England, put the sofa, the Argo, everything on board her, nailed it down and set sail for the sea. And actually, they called into Ireland for a brief visit. And we dropped anchor in a place called Glandour in West Cork, which probably a lot of the people listening will know. It's absolutely glorious. And I think the beauty of the area captured my parents and they never lifted anchor and never left again.
And
so
that
I
was
actually
it.
Was born there, yes.
And you were born? That's incredible. So the sea and sailing is pretty much, it's in your blood, right?
It's in my bones. In fact, I've just come back from a beautiful trip, which was helping to deliver a yacht from Lisbon, Portugal, into Kinsale in Cork. And we had the most gorgeous trip. The weather, the dolphins, the sea, being seasick, not being able to eat and not getting any sleep because you're on watch. That's in my soul. And I love that sort of challenge as well. And I'm in my 50s now and I still like to be challenged.
Good on you. Good on you. So even if you're used to the sea, sorry, you just mentioned there, you still can suffer from seasickness. Does that not leave you at all? Come on.
No, I'm afraid not.
Oh, no.
Even when I worked on the sea and I worked with my late husband on a scuba dive vessel taking recreational divers to dive sites, the first few days of the season, I would not be able to smoke my cigarette on board and I would not be able to drink my coffee or read my book. But a week later, I was
doing
all three.
Oh.
I hasten to add, I don't smoke anymore, though.
Good on you. Let's start. I don't know where to start. You've quite a lot to talk about, but let's talk about your brother, Dominic, first of all. Can you tell me about him?
Yeah, a great guy. And we were born just a year apart, so we're the quintessential Irish twins. Mm. And we had a wonderful time playing by the sea, being on boats, rowing out to catch our own food as children. And we were sort of connected in a beautiful way, in a heart way. And he actually became a delivery skipper, which was taking yachts across the Atlantic at a very, very young age. And one of the trips he took was actually with one of my best friends, Lorraine, now, in a 25-foot boat across the Atlantic, only three of them. So he was another adventurer and a risk taker and one of these people who lived life to the full. So it was terribly tragic, Jennifer, when he got cancer at a very young age and died with me at the age of 28.
28. Wow, that is so young. What impact did that have on you? You're so close. He's so young.
The impact, I think, was equivalent to an emotional bomb going off, to be honest. You know, our childhood hadn't been that happy. And, you know, you get sort of fused together in challenge. And we were almost symbiotic in the sense that we were almost the one person. We were that close physically in age and actually emotionally very close. So it was as if a part of me went with him that day. And, you know, the grief and the isolation, and the loneliness from that actually weighed very, very heavy on me. And in a way, you know, when I was sailing the other day and I was on watch on my own looking at the stars the other night, you know, hundreds of miles away from the land. And, you know, he came to me in that moment and I was grief stricken. And at the same time, I was proud because I was following his legacy and I was bringing his energy onto the sea again. But I think about him every day.
Wow. such a trauma to go through. And after such a trauma, you found Nick. Is that right?
That's right. Another seaman.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a theme in my life. Yeah, you can hear it. So he came in to actually the harbour I lived in at the time. I had a restaurant. I was a bit of a young starter and I had a restaurant at the age of 23. And this tall, lanky man came, balding man came into the restaurant, and I knew that minute that I met him, actually, he was going to be significant in my life. And so, we met. And a year after Dominic died, actually, we were married. And 3 months later, I was pregnant with our daughter, Nicola.
Wow. So a whirlwind.
Whirlwind. And he was a lot older than me also.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then what happened?
Well, what happened was catastrophic. There's no two ways about it. It was when I met Nick, it was as if, you know, the God or the universe was giving me something back. And it was very special. We had a wonderful relationship and he was very steady and calm and loved me. And, you know, being pregnant with Nicola, we actually didn't plan to have children so soon, but it was a great joy. And we had this lovely business together on the sea every day. And so it was the 24th of July in 1998, when I was 6 months pregnant. He came to me actually in the house, and I could tell by the look on his face, he was, you know, we wanted a favor. And because I was the, you know, driving or diving equivalent of the designated driver, because I was pregnant. Mm-hmm. So that means no diving. Mm-hmm. So that means you're a great person to man the boat. So he came to me and he said, is there any chance you take the boat tonight? Because it was one of those gorgeous days, you know, pristine day. And I looked at him and I actually said to him, do you love me? You know the way you joke. And he said, you'll never know how much. And I said, you're on. So I went down to the pier and I boarded the boat and he was preparing his equipment. And it was a revolutionary bit of equipment, actually, because it was called a rebreather. Now, anyone who's been scuba diving may have heard of it, but just for people who haven't heard of it, it's very different to ordinary scuba dive equipment, where you have a regulator and you have bubbles coming up and you breathe out the air and it's exhausted through the water. In a rebreather, it's a closed loop system. So basically what it means is there are no bubbles and there's a computer system and a scrubber which takes out the exhaled carbon dioxide and replaces it with more oxygen. So the beauty of that is you get deeper dive, longer bottom time and no bubbles. So you get to see a lot more. So he was preparing this equipment and he said to me, it's not giving me the safe to dive. So I actually didn't take any notice and I went on board and I heard him say sometime later, oh, it's all right now. So I put 12 divers into the water that night. Nick was the last to go in. And I took the boat up above the sun, which is customary because you've got to be able to see down in your dive site. So that's what I did. And there was another wife on board and she called me and she said, somebody's waving their arm in the water. And I just took the boat alongside and asked what was happening. And there was consternation and panic in this poor man because he said, Nick's convulsing on the bottom. And what occurred after that, Jennifer, was nothing short of actually being playing a part in a movie. Mm. I don't know if you can imagine, but, you know, it's like life slowed down for me because I heard it was Nick, but yet I sort of slipped into this motion of emergency procedures. And at the same time, one part of me was screaming inside and the other part of me knew that I had to keep it together. I needed to do procedural events and I needed to call a mayday and get a helicopter assistance. So that's exactly what I did. And at the same time, I revved the engine out of gear. So all the divers came up. That's a procedure. And Nick never came back. So, you know, in those moments, you know, I'm pregnant and my mind won't let me know really what's going on. And I'm continuing to do the emergency procedures, but I split in two halves that day. I remember sort of mentally not allowing it to happen. And of course, later he actually was brought to the surface and he was lifted off the boat. The lifeboat boarded and I was not allowed to be lifted with him. And the last thing I saw, actually, of my husband was him being raised from the deck with a winch man and disappearing up into the body of a helicopter. And I had 3 hours to go before I could get to the hospital. So it was quite a journey.
How old are you at this stage when you're pregnant and a widow?
I became a widow, actually, at just over age 29.
Wow. Mm-hmm. That must have been the longest journey of your life to get to that hospital.
It was, I clearly remember it, Jennifer. And do you know what it was? Was, you know, I'm sure people who've gone through the grief process, and many of us have, none of us are untouched by trauma. It's that bargaining that goes on. And there's a kind of an argument that goes on, and a bargaining with whoever you believe in or whatever you believe in of, you know, please don't let this be true. I promise I'll be good for the rest of my, you know, it's that mad conversation that goes on. And I'm sure people listening will know that one, because, you know, grief and shock and trauma bring out some, you know, energies and chemistries in our system that we will fight tooth and nail to make it not the truth.
But you had just been through something extremely traumatic, and then to have this happen so soon after is just incredible.
Yeah, what, absolutely. And what I will attest to, funny enough, is actually the strength of the human spirit here, because it seemed as if this was, you know, it was relentless.
Yeah.
I hadn't actually processed Dominic's grief, actually. I was still crying at night from that.
Of course.
And then to go home to my house and only have my family and my best friends around me, and to get into that bed that night, you know, I didn't take on board the full import of it. It took months and months and months. And of course, then 3 months later, I had to go into labour, and with my gorgeous best friend, Lorraine, at my side. But that wasn't who I wanted to be at my best, at my side that night and that day. So I think that, you know, we can't really find words adequate enough to explain that. And, you know, this is why I share my story, Jennifer, because I know what it felt like to not have those words and to not be able to put, to articulate and to ask for help and to reach out, because it's nothing I'd experienced before. And I always encourage people, no matter what it is that's going on, find some tiny bit of language or words and keep reaching out until you are heard. Because nowadays we know how much help we can get when we're traumatized. And in those days, it wasn't quite such a topic. So I was basically left isolated and trapped in this whole PTSD symptoms, which were, you know, flashbacks and sweats and, you know, panic attacks, all sorts of things. I couldn't sleep. I didn't know actually that it could have been helped. And I think that if I'd have known to ask for more help, it would have been, you know, it would have shortened at least my loneliness and my grief a little bit.
When did you start to notice your own health deteriorate?
I actually had, my health was deteriorating commensurate with the PTSD and flashbacks and insomnia. Nicola was very sick when she was born. She actually had a birthmark that took most of the sight in her left eye. So I was up and down to Kremlin. I was traveling. She was on steroids. I had grief, complex grief at this point. So I never noticed what was happening to me when, for instance, I would drive on the wrong side of the road. And, you know, when I look back, I think, how could I have been so actually ill with trauma that I never noticed that I didn't, my hand sometimes wouldn't touch the gear stick and I didn't know what to do in the car. And I even didn't recognize, Jennifer, I started to have to crawl at night to give Nicola a bottle. And I never registered that this was abnormal. So that will tell you the depth I had sunk to in my trauma and in my isolation and in my loneliness and in my fed upness, quite frankly, with life. I was just done. So I plodded my way through. And really, I should have been in a hospital a long time ago. But of course, I added it all up to trauma. So it was really the morning I came to on my back with Nicola sitting on me, screaming, "Don't die, mummy," was when it all came to a head that I was actually seriously ill. And I was rushed to Cork University College Hospital in Cork. And I saw a lot of shaking heads and, you know, people going, "Oh, well, can't," you know, that body language when you can see people discussing you and they're not looking at you. And I remember the test I had, which was to send a little camera into my brain. And they very calmly came back to me and said, "You actually have a very large benign brain tumor and it's growing and there's nothing we can do to save you."
How old is your daughter at this point?
Nicola was about 6.
Wow. You've had a rough deal so far. My God. So to hear that kind of news, What's that like? I mean, after all you've been through.
Yeah.
Does it sink in at all?
Again, it's a bit like Nick's accident.
Yeah.
I remember wanting to laugh, Jennifer, actually. I remember wanting to put my hand over my face and giggle. You know, when you get some ridiculous news, actually, sometimes people just collapse in laughter.
Like, oh, come on.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, here we go again.
I didn't believe it. Wow. I actually did not believe him. And I actually thought it's one of these movies where they've got the wrong person. And in a minute, they're going to come in and say, you know, we're very sorry. Yeah, we mixed you up with somebody else. But actually, they didn't. And I was actually sent home with medication, Jennifer. And I remember scratching my head with a girlfriend, Breeda. And we went to the pub when I was discharged, because basically I didn't realise the full import of what was to happen. And it only really became clear over time that they were serious, that I actually wasn't going to be around in about 2 years' time, that I'd have a massive brain hemorrhage and die. I had a small girl. And when that started to really drift into my consciousness and my unconsciousness, that's when I started to think, oh my goodness, now I really have to dig deep. And now I have to find a solution. I am not going to die. And so that was the next step.
Finding that strength is remarkable. Your refusal to give up because of your daughter. And you found someone, didn't you, who was willing to operate on you. Tell me about this surgeon.
Yeah, I talk about him a lot. Mr. Richard Nelson, we better announce his name, because he actually came out of the woodwork through my sister-in-law. And we had been to about 6 or 7 urology departments in 6 or 7 different hospitals at this point in time. And the result was the same. You know, there's nothing we can do. You need to go and write your will, sort out your daughter, put in guardianship and all of that. So out of the woodwork comes this fantastic offer from a man in Bristol, and he says, I'll give it a go. And basically that's what it was. And your chances of survival are this. If you do survive, you are going to be paralyzed down the left-hand side of your body for the rest of your life. So you need to think about that and basically come back to me. I never met him, Jennifer. I didn't see the man. So it was kind of strange now when we look back, because we've got, you know, FaceTime and all of this stuff. He actually wrote me a letter that arrived in the post. And this was just before, this was in about December, sorry. So I had to go and have a preparatory operation in London first, because there was no treatment available in this country, in Ireland. It was just too complex. So I had a procedure which was actually basically to glue shut some of the arteries. And that alone in itself, that operation was so risky, because I was at risk of a stroke, whether too much glue or too little glue. Either way, it could be catastrophic. Needless to say, I survived that. And then in January, January the 6th, 2006, I walked down a ward into a neurology operating theatre, and there was a team of, I don't know, maybe 15 people there. And I underwent 15 hours of neurosurgery. And at the end of it, Richard Nelson went into my mum and my brother, and he said, you know, the good news is she's alive. The bad news is we can't wake her up. And what transpired was I was actually having an intracranial bleed. I was bleeding into my brain, and they wanted to wake me up, put me under again. And the strange thing is, Jennifer, I'm not really a great believer in these stories of near-death experiences, but I was unconscious at the time. And somebody came to me, and I heard somebody, and they said, you know, we're going to operate again. And I heard that person unconscious, and I managed to climb that cliff to consciousness just enough to be able to say don't. And the nurse heard me and they stopped. And I 100,000% believe, Jennifer, I would not be alive right now sitting in front of you, fully recovered, fully healed, and doing what I do in life if I hadn't have said that. I think I'd have died in the next operation. I felt my lifeblood was just ebbing away from me.
But come here, Richard was wrong. He said, we're going to do this operation, and she, you know, wouldn't be able to move the left side of her body. You're sitting here in front of me, able-bodied. Mm. I was expecting a wheelchair, if I'm honest with you, and get him on the phone. It's like it's a miracle.
I was paralyzed, Jennifer.
You were.
I was paralyzed. I am a recovered person. I was completely paralyzed down the left-hand side of my body. But I'm not today. And this is the reason why I share my story again, because we can get into such terrible places in our lives and we can lose hope and we can feel that there's nothing left for us and we can feel there's not a choice even left for us. Mm. And I'm a great believer in there will always be a choice. I did recover. I have a bit of a wonky left arm and I had to learn to be right-handed. You know, so many things I had to overcome. And it took time. I'm not pretending it didn't, you know, and it took tears and sweat and stress and sticking to it.
Mentally, but how did you do that, though?
Mentally, I just what I say is I kept one eye on the job and the other eye on my vision of my future. And my vision of my future was actually to be a parent who Nicola could be, you know, proud of and have a mother who could go out and do stuff with. And that was my real focus and meaning. And that's how. And I think that the way we come through our difficulties is to spend a little bit of time focusing on why, our why. Why are we doing this? Because if we don't narrow down that goal and that vision and also make a decision as well that I am going to put my all into it and be kind of, I had to be very disciplined about what I thought. And also I had to rewire my body. You know, I had to get this working again. And I clumsily knew that what I thought about and what I visualized really, really was the most important thing in the world. So I kept that vision very close in my mind and I kept that life blood in me going and trust. And I also accepted, which I think is important, Jennifer, that life is never really going to be perfect. We will all have messy bits. Now, some more than others. And I speak from experience because some people say to me, but it's okay for you, Rachel. No, I had to go through the messy bits. You know, I'm at the recovered stage. But the reason why I'm here to speak is to give that carrot, you know, that bit of impetus, that bit of motivation to say that whatever your T is, small T, big T, being trauma, or whatever your loss, your grief is, that life has a way of moving us forward. And we don't like that when we're hurting. We don't want to know about that when the distance is coming between us and a loved one. But the point is that we have a life to lead and we must find some kind of meaning within it, even in our pain. And that's what I think I established, was to find that bit of meaning and find practices that work for you each day, something small. And all we're doing is we're taking baby steps out of this stuff.
What would you say to someone, I hate using the phrase, lost the fight or the will to fight, because I do find with people who are ill, it's not a battle sometimes, and, you know, especially cancer or stuff like that. And mentally, it's very difficult for them, especially, I mean, you yourself were given 2 years to live. Like, that's what they said to you. What would you say to anybody who's listening, who's been given such terrible news and are in a place of darkness?
Yeah, that is a really interesting question because it will be different for everybody. My experience is that we have a certain amount of energy to give at any point in time. And often that we can be denied the place that we have. So if you've been diagnosed with cancer or you've got some loss in your life, it's the people around us often that can't, you know, identify with what we're going through. And of course they can't because they don't want us to be in that place. So often there's a lot of disparate conversations that go on. So what I would suggest you do, first of all, is before you do anything else, is let yourself off the hook from having to strive, to push, to do anything, because our energy goes up and down. If you can see my hand, it's a loop. It's going up and down. So we kind of catch the wave, basically. The days when we're not able, what we do is we pull back and we say, I'm in a resting phase right now. I don't need to do anything right now. And you'll find there's a little chink maybe later in the day or the next day. Mm. There's just a slight change in your energy or in your mindset. That's when you just do a little bit more. And remember that we're human. It's okay to fall apart. And that is one thing that I think is the most important thing. Ah, she's been very strong. That is the most isolating bit of information to be given if you're sick or you're hurting.
Yeah.
Because that almost is saying, don't tell us your pain.
It's not okay.
Don't tell us your pain. So what I say is, it's okay not to be strong and it's okay to cry. It's okay to fall apart. A lot of my clients who I work with, I actually encourage them to fall apart because I say, when you fall apart, you will naturally fall back together. And it's the biggest fear that people have is actually, if I let go and fall apart, I'll never, ever recover from this. But I promise you, you will. So it's a brave thing to fall apart, but it's a very important part of your recovery indeed.
Good advice. There is so much more to your story. We haven't even scratched the surface. Rachel Gatto, author of Flying on the Inside. I just want to thank you for making the trip up to Dublin and speaking to us here in the studio. And if you want to check out Rachel, go to rachelgatto.com. We'll be right back after these.
Jennifer Zaffarelli.
Weekday morning from 9
on 2FM.